Economic Assistance Programs, and we have Assistant Commissioner Chuck Johnson with us today.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. I'm Chuck Johnson, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services with the Department of Human Services. I'm prepared today to do the base level review of the activities within the Children and Family Services Administration. Children and Family Services Administration oversees all the major programs that impact families and children within the Department of Human Services and the Human Services System, including our public assistance programs, MFIP, food stamps, general assistance.
If I can just interrupt you, members, you should be turning to your book on page 37.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Child care, child support enforcement, child welfare services, child protection, foster care, adoption, and so forth. In addition to that, we have some programs that aren't directly targeted to families and children but are within our administration, including housing. The Ending Long-Term Homes Initiative is part of what we work on, the Group Residential Housing Program. We oversee the community action agencies, and we also oversee refugee services. Projecting this biennium, we'll spend slightly over $2 billion on these programs within CFS. Over half of that is federal funding. Most of the programs that we operate are state-federal shared programs. Some are wholly federal, some are wholly state. Because Minnesota is a state-supervised, county-administered system, the role of the department is to oversee, for the most part, what the counties do in delivering the programs at the local level. That includes training, policy guidance, and oversight. System support and infrastructure, a very important part of what we do, providing the computer systems that counties use. Quality control and quality assurance around compliance and program improvement. Reporting, fiscal management functions, as well as grant oversight and grant management of the grants that are provided to counties and to others. Madam Chair, I'll start with the first budget activity, which shows on page 40 of your book. This is the Minnesota Family Investment Program Diversionary Work Program grants. These are the grants that are paid to participating families in MFIP and DWP cash grants, and the food assistance is paid to MFIP families. The MFIP program is Minnesota's TANF program, which is the Federal Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. It's basically our welfare reform program targeted toward families. The goal is to help families transition from welfare into work and self-sufficiency. Most minor parents with minor children are eligible for the MFIP program. Eligibility is limited to 60 months. There's a 60-month time limit in the program. Once families come into the program, they begin to receive the cash grants. They also then receive work services and so forth. This page addresses only the cost or the budget for the grants that are actually paid to the families. In addition to the MFIP program, this page covers the Diversionary Work Program, which was created in the 2003 legislature. Implemented in 2004. This program now includes the families, many of whom are the first applicants for MFIP. Instead of going into the MFIP program, they initially go into the Diversionary Work Program, which is a short-term, four-month program, very focused on trying to move families quickly into work with the hope that they can avoid coming into the MFIP program altogether. Families in the Diversionary Work Program do not accumulate 60 months toward the 60-month time limit, which is helpful in terms of the family situation if they can exit the program without going into MFIP. On the top of page 41, I wanted to point your attention to a bar chart that shows there that's labeled MFIP work participation rate. As I mentioned the other day, there will probably be much discussion this session around the reauthorization of TANF legislation and how that will affect Minnesota's need to meet a work participation rate that has been increased under the TANF regulations. I wanted to point out that the bar chart that shows here is not the TANF work participation rate that the federal government measures. This is an MFIP work participation rate that is created in state law that we use for the purpose of measuring county performance. Prior to reauthorization, we wanted to have a measure that more wholly represented what we're trying to do within Minnesota's program and not so much just how the feds measure our performance. We are proposing actually to align the measures so that we will be now measuring counties based on what the feds are actually measuring us on, which is the TANF work participation rate. And for reference, most notably, I would tell you that in federal fiscal year 2006, the state's performance on the TANF work participation rate was 32.6%. So that's the base where we are at. prior to moving into reauthorization. Members, the budget for MFIP diversionary work grants shows on page 43 of your budget book, as this is state and federal dollars totaling about $540 million over the biennium.
Well, that went pretty fast. Maybe you could just explain to us for a minute, and I don't see it broken out on the on page 43, but what part of our TANF grants go to the counties to provide assistance to clients that might need assistance in terms of work search or other program needs they have?
Madam Chair, the budget in this activity concerns only the grants that are paid to individuals, to individual families, including both the cash grants that are paid and the food grants that are paid to the MFIP families. The work services are actually in the next budget activity.
Okay. Then it's not surprising I don't see it here. So are there any questions on this portion? Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, could you explain briefly what the just very generally what the difference in measures are between the MFIP and TANF measures that you were describing, and whether those switch in measures is likely to affect the dollars going to counties?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, the MFIP work participation rate, the one that shows here that we have been using to measure county performance, includes in the activities that we look at the same activities that are covered within the federal law. So by activities, I mean work activities, what counts toward the work participation rate. The work participation rate is essentially a measure of how many families within our MFIP caseload are participating in certain activities a certain number of hours every week, and that's calculated on a monthly basis and then average for the year. The numerator of that, which is the number of people that are in work activities under the MFIP work participation rate, is very similar to the TANF work participation rate. The difference mostly here is what's in the denominator, or which families we count as part of looking at this. And what we have been doing with counties and in the MFIP work participation rate prior to reauthorization of TANF is looking at the whole of the families that we have within the MFIP program, and particularly including two-parent families, which for the purposes of our federal rate for the last several years, we had removed from our federal rate by funding them through a different structure. By including the two-parent families, we actually bump up what the rate looks like, because two-parent families do tend to work more and have more work activities than you might see with just the single-parent population. That's the major difference between the two. In terms of what it will mean for counties, it will become more challenging for counties to meet the target work participation rate that's in law right now. The consolidated fund funding under the consolidated fund, which is in the next budget activity for counties in MFIP, has a portion of the funding based on their performance on the work participation rate and on the self-support index, which is on the bottom of this page. And the target is currently set at 50%, which is consistent with the expectation that is now in place from the federal government. But because we're changing the calculation, it will make it somewhat harder for counties to reach that 50%. I need to caveat all of that by saying that's all without regard to whatever might come out of this legislative session in terms of changes to the MFIP program that would affect the way the TANF work participation rate is counted, which would then affect the way we count it for counties and how it would relate to their ability to meet the target.
And Senator Olson, just so you know, in addition to the budget pages that we'll go over regarding the governor's recommendations for this program, I also have been working on a bill for a couple of years now on TANF compliance, and we'll be introducing that bill shortly.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions? Okay, let's move on then.
Madam Chair, the next base budget page is page 51 of your book. This page covers the support service grants. This includes the funding for both the Minnesota Family Investment Program Consolidated Fund, and also for the Food Stamp Employment and Training Program. These are both grants that are provided to counties to provide services to low-income families. In the case of the MFIP Consolidated Fund, this was a fund that was created in 2003 from a number of separate funding sources that were combined together to create this consolidated fund. The three main sources of funding that were combined together in 2003 to make the consolidated fund were what had been a pre-existing block grant account for MFIP Employment Services, pre-existing chunk of money that was available to counties for the administrative costs, the federal share of the administrative costs that they actually have to pay their workers to administer eligibility and benefits for the program. And then thirdly, an amount of money that represented the capped amount of the, based on the 2002 expenditures in what existed previously as an entitlement program called the Emergency Assistance Program. That program in 2003 was repealed. The capped amount of the dollars that had been spent in 2002 were rolled into the consolidated fund. So currently in the consolidated fund, which is about $111 million a year, these dollars are allocated out to counties, and counties use those dollars to meet all their obligations under the MFIP program, including the administrative requirements in law, all the employment training services they provide, the services we provide around the 60-month time limit and determining extensions and so forth, as well as paying for half of the cost of the basic administration of the program. The counties are still required to pay for half of those costs. As well as at county option to provide an emergency needs program to families as determined under county policy. And currently all but one counties do provide emergency needs to families in their county using these funds. In addition to this, and you can see in the middle of the page, some of the kinds of services are listed, including the kinds of work services that will be provided. The exact kinds of services that are provided are driven somewhat by state law in terms of the counties have to employ job counselors. Many of them contract for those services. The job counselors develop an employment plan with participants. That plan may include activities including job search, which they may fund with these dollars, education, basic education, ESL, and so forth, as well as helping families move directly into jobs and providing referrals to other services. The other funding that's on this page, which is significantly smaller, is the Food Stamp Employment and Training Program. This is largely a pass-through at this point of federal dollars. It's a small amount of state dollars that still exists to provide services to food stamp recipients who are not in the MFIP program. Those who are between the ages of 18 and 50 are required under federal law to participate in a Food Stamp Employment and Training Program, and these dollars support the county efforts in that regard. On page 54 is the fiscal information for this activity. Again, there are state and federal dollars involved in the activity. We largely use federal TANF dollars to fund these activities, but there is some state general fund included as well.
And Assistant Commissioner, do you have someplace listed on one of the sheets for your division here, the complement, the number of employees that are engaged in these activities?
Madam Chair, are you referring to the number of employees at the local level?
No, at the state level.
Madam Chair, in the administrative budget pages that are toward the end of our pages, we do have FTEs that are related to the administration of the MFIP program, including the consolidated fund and the grant piece of the program.
All right, so we'll get to that a little later. Thank you. Are there any questions? Continue then.
Madam Chair and members, the next budget activity is on page 55 of your book. This is MFIP Child Care Assistance Grants. Excuse me. Child Care Assistance Grants provide subsidies to families to help them pay for child care. This activity covers MFIP families, so it covers any MFIP family who is in need of child care in order to work or engage in any approved work activities that are part of their employment plan. This activity also covers transition year. Under Minnesota state law, when a family exits MFIP, they are guaranteed a year of child care assistance as they transition off of assistance and into work. And so this activity covers both the child care for families while they're on MFIP and also that transition year as they leave MFIP. This also covers child care for the diversionary work program participants as well in a similar fashion. Child care assistance is provided to these families based on the family first making a choice of where they would like to have care provided. And as long as they are choosing a legal provider, we will then reimburse the provider for the cost of that care up to the maximum rates that are set by state law for reimbursement of those services, minus the copayment that the family is required to pay. And the copayments are based on the family's income on a sliding scale. So smaller copayments for lower income families, higher as you get further up the scale, for example, for a transition year family who may be working in office assistance. There are three types of care generally that families seek, or we categorize them in three ways. Center-based care, which is in child care centers. Licensed family homes, which is another category of licensed care, which is a care that is licensed for someone to provide in their home for a certain number of kids, and there are some rules around which kids they can have and how many and so forth. And in addition, what's called legally non-licensed, or we sometimes call family, friend, and neighbor care. This is care that is allowed to be provided under Minnesota law without a license as long as the caregiver is providing for care for only their own children and the children from one other family. And we pay for that care reimburse the provider as we do for licensed care in Minnesota. If you look at the measures at the bottom of the page, I would note for you what we're measuring there and try to interpret a little bit for you. The first line under key measures, what we're measuring here is looking at where the maximum rates are set right now within the child care assistance program, and then trying to determine a measure of what kind of coverage are we providing in terms of what kind of access does an individual have if what they're carrying is our subsidy rate out into the market to look for care. And if you look over on the first line here that shows sort of the statewide number and go over to the right where it says SFY 2007, this is essentially our current status. We do a market survey every year of the market rates in child care across the state. And this is comparing those market rates currently under, this is our 2006 survey, to the maximum rates that are in law right now. And the way to interpret this is that for family child care, about 65.3% of the licensed family child care in Minnesota are at or below the maximum rate that we will pay. In other words, about 65.3% are accessible without the parent having to put out any additional money beyond their copay to be able to access that care. And for the centers, the number is lower, 54.5%. This is a way we sort of track what level of access we're providing under the current rates in law. Madam Chair and members, the budget for this activity is on page 57. Roughly $200 million in the biennium for MFIP transition year child care. This is funded by general fund dollars as well as by federal child care development fund dollars, which is a block grant that's given to states for child care purposes, as well as some TANF transfers that have been used to fund child care in Minnesota. If there are no questions, I'll move on to the next activity, which is further away than I thought, on page 60 of your book. This is the other part of our child care subsidy program called the Basic Sliding Fee Child Care Program. Basic sliding fee child care assistance provides child care assistance to not the families that are on MFIP transition year, as we just talked about, but other low-income working families who are in need of child care assistance in order to retain employment or participate in other allowable activities. The eligibility for this program is currently set at 175% of poverty for the entrance eligibility. In other words, at the point that you apply for assistance, your income must be below 175 of poverty. And the exit eligibility is set at 250% of poverty. So essentially, once a family gets into the program, they can continue to receive a subsidy for child care assistance up to 250% of poverty. This program, unlike the MFIP transition year program, is not a forecasted program, meaning that in the MFIP transition year program, if a family is eligible, we will provide them with assistance without regard to what the current state appropriation is because it's forecasted and we adjust the forecast based on what the need is. The basic sliding fee program is a fixed appropriation, meaning that we receive a fixed appropriation every year, every 2 years from the legislature. We then allocate that those dollars out on a formula that's provided in state law to counties, and counties then administer with the dollars they're given to reach as many families as they can within that county. As a result of the fact that this appropriation is fixed, we're not able to meet all the current need that's out there for child care amongst the eligible low-income families, and we currently have a waiting list of about 3,500 families in the basic sliding fee program. I would also mention there's another small sub-program within the basic sliding fee program called At-Home Infant Child Care, which is funded out of a 3% set-aside from the basic sliding fee appropriation. At-Home Infant Care, or AHIC as it's called, is a program that that allows low-income parents to stay home with their children for the first year, even though that may be something they couldn't otherwise do given their need for income and the fact that they are a low-income family and that it's difficult for them to take time out of work. By paying that family essentially a subsidy that is equal to 90% of what we would pay to a family child care provider for up to a year for them to stay home with an infant. And the idea here was to give low-income parents the same opportunity to stay at home as many of us in the higher income range are able to do because of our ability to use benefits and our income and so forth to make that possible. Understanding that, of course, one of the best things that can happen for an infant is to have a parent home with them for the first year of life. The budget for this activity is on page 62.
How long does that program, I mean, how old is a child when that program ends for them?
It is provided for the first year of life, so it's up until the child is 1 year old. Madam Chair. Was that the question?
Yes.
Okay, thank
Madam
you.
Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I don't remember when it was first created. It was sometime, I would guess, in the later part of the 90s. And then it was repealed, I think, in 2003. And then it was recreated in 2004. I believe that that's the history.
Any other questions on this item? And how much is this item?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't have exact numbers. Let's see if someone knows. It's 3% of the appropriation for basic sliding fee. I believe of the general fund appropriation for basic sliding fee. We can get that number for you, Madam Chair.
So when basic sliding fee appropriations go up, this program automatically goes up also?
Madam Chair, that's the way it would work under current law. That's correct.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, it's...
Okay, let's keep going.
I do have the number, Madam Chair. It's a little over $1 million, but $1.1 million for fiscal year 2007.
And that's just for 1 year of the biennium?
That's correct.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the fiscal information for basic sliding fee child care assistance grants are found on page 62, similar to the MFIP and transition year program. This is funded with state general fund dollars and with federal dollars from the Child Care Development Fund as well as TANF transfers.
Other questions? All right, let's move on then.
Madam Chair, members, the next budget activity is on page 63. This activity is child care development grants. Under federal law, states are required to use a minimum of 4% of the child care development fund that we receive from the federal government for development and quality activities. This page represents the activities that Minnesota carries out. In addition to the federal funding, there are general fund appropriations that support this activity in Minnesota. The goal of these activities is really to promote school readiness and quality care for children and also to support the development of child care and the stability of child care within the industry, essentially, to have a market of child care for parents to choose from. We do this mostly through grant activities. One of our major partners in this activity is their child care resource and referral organizations, which you may be familiar with, are spread out across the state. These are nonprofit organizations that are supported largely through contracts from our department that provide a number of services in the community around child care, both for parents and for the providers in the community. There's a series of different activities that we do with these dollars. Professional development for child care teachers and caregivers, that is essentially training that we organize and carry out, as well as working with others to do both through the CCR and our network, the Child Care Resource and Referrals, again, as well as other professionals who work within the industry. And we brought training to 35,000 participants last year. And we particularly tried to focus many of these activities on tying into some of the school readiness work that's being done and trying to see that in the early childhood years it's being provided through childcare, that there's a tie-in in terms of what kind of things we're focusing on there with the progression that's been created within the K-12 system. So the kids come into kindergarten and then are progressing through a similar kind of system of domains that we're focusing on in the developmental goals for children, starting with 0 to 3 and then 4 to 5 and then into the kindergarten and school years. We also provide child care referrals. This is done through the Child Care Resource and Referral Network. This is to help parents locate care, identify care that's available in their community, and give them information to try to make decisions on what kind of care they want to select for their children. We also provide grants and financial supports to child care providers. Some of this is to improve facilities. Someone wants to create an infant program, needs to do something to create a room that's going to comply with licensing or whatever. We can give them a grant to help with that. For family home providers to do some of the things they need to do to comply with licensing, to be in a position where they can become licensed and provide care in the community and so forth. This also includes some scholarships for higher education to help retain individuals working in the child care field, which can be very difficult because it's not a very high-paying field and obviously is critically important service that they're providing to the kids of Minnesota. And then finally, we do some direct and some through contracts, consultation, mentoring, coaching, and technical assistance to providers in the community. The fiscal information for this activity is found on page 66. As I mentioned earlier, it is largely federal dollars, but there are some state general fund dollars included here as well.
Questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Johnson. Tell me more about the referral process. Does it automatically, when somebody wants to be in a child care facility, do they automatically apply to you, or do they have to voluntarily phone us in? And
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, in terms of the providers connecting with us, it's the responsibility of the local CCR to know their local market and to identify the providers in that market. So they try to work with the provider community to know who's there. But the providers also, this part of this is done through the web. There is a website that parents can access to identify care that's available in their area. There is some responsibility incumbent on providers to make themselves known through that system and through the CCR and ours. So there are phone referrals, web referrals, and then in addition, people can come into the office and get a paper listing of the providers that might be available in their area as well.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. How is this grant program? Are you working with the grant and the MELF? I mean, is there a relationship developed with those organizations? So.
Absolutely, Madam Chair, Senator Rosen. Yes, in fact, we are working with MELF on an aspect that sort of plays off of this. The child care resource and referral right now is largely a function of here's what's in your community. Here are the providers, the licensed providers that are in your community. And in addition, some information, if you're interested, in what you should be looking for when you're looking for child care, what kind of things you should be looking for, what if you're concerned about quality or pre-K preparation, look for this and so on and so forth. We're currently working with MELF on sort of taking that to a next level and developing what would be called a quality rating system to look more at how we actually measure and rate quality amongst child care providers. And we're working with them on a number of pilots of a quality rating system, some in the metro area, also both in the core cities, in suburban area, and also in a couple of places outside the metro area. And that's been a partnership that's just come together within the last few months, and so we're still working on pulling together the details of it. But the idea is to pilot a quality rating system and figure out how that works in terms of particularly of helping parents make better decisions about childcare, but also in terms of driving the provider community to think about what are they providing and are they providing the kind of care that we're representing as being the kind of quality care that's going to get kids ready for kindergarten. In addition to that, I think we're working with MELF on this with an understanding there are a number of other pieces that they've sort of tied into it. Our focus is really on this QRS piece.
Thank you.
And I think we'll be getting more information about that when we go through the governor's budget recommendations. But I would just like to remind everyone here that our programs do not pay market rate to child care providers. And so when we talk about quality, we need to always keep that in mind unless or until we fix it. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would be interested in knowing what percentage of women in Minnesota, I know we've had those figures before, but you know, we have a larger percentage of women working.
Mm-hmm. We do. We do. We can maybe see if Joan can find that for us.
Just the general.
Okay. I have a couple of questions regarding this section. One of them is, the federal funds, do any of these programs require some state matching dollars?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure of the answer to that. I'll see if staff here knows.
And the second part of that would be whether we have any discretion with the federal dollars or whether we have to spend them on the programs that we're spending them on.
Madam Chair, we do have some discretion. There are some requirements within the federal law. There are some general parameters of how the dollars have to be used. And there are, as I understand, some particular set-asides that have to be done in a certain way. For example, I believe there's a set-aside for child care resource and referrals. But within that, there is some flexibility about how we target those dollars, what proportion we use for training versus for grants to providers and so forth.
Maybe you could get some of that detail to our staff.
We'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Are there other questions? Not, let's continue then.
Madam Chair, members, the next budget activity is on page 67. This is child support enforcement grants. Minnesota Department of Human Services operates the child support enforcement program for the state of Minnesota. This is a program that, as its title suggests, is involved in the enforcement of child support orders for the state as those orders are made by courts. You'll see up in the activity box in the upper right-hand corner there, we collected almost $600 million in child support, distributed almost $600 million in child support in the last year, and serve about 250,000 families. This is one of those programs that extends well beyond sort of the more low-income core that we usually are focusing our programs on and where we touch the lives of many families across the diversity of Minnesota. The program started, child support, really started child support enforcement, focused on the families at that time and on AFDC, and the idea was really as essentially a revenue collection mechanism to try to get some repayment for the cost of AFDC when there was a usually dad who wasn't in the picture and the mother and children were receiving assistance. But it has evolved significantly beyond that, where most of the families that we serve now are non-public assistance families who come in and apply for services to get help with their child support enforcement. This is another activity that we carry out through the counties. The counties have a very strong and important role in this. And obviously the courts are an important partner in this as well, because ultimately it's the courts that determine what level of payment a family has and put enforcement mechanisms in place to do that. So there's a lot of interaction at the local level between the child support officers who usually work in the Human Services Department, county attorney's office, and the courts in the local areas. These activities are there's a multiple of activities here, including establishing paternity, where paternity is not known or where it's only suspected, and we need to have proof to establish paternity in order to pursue the child support, working with individuals and trying to establish paternity, establishing and modifying orders for court support, medical support, child care support. Again, the county has a role in working with the courts to see that those orders are put in place. Collecting and dispersing support. We have a large collection system. We receipt checks and then send the checks back out, distributed based on the federal rules about where the dollars go. Oftentimes we have payers who have multiple child support obligations to different children and different families, and there are rules around how the dollars go. Sometimes dollars are retained by the state to pay back public assistance from the past and so forth. It's a very complicated distribution system that is highly automated and run through our department. In addition, we do enforcement, which involves intercepting tax refunds, lottery winnings, Also locating non-paying parents, trying to find where the parent may be even when they're outside of Minnesota, and using some other sort of non-fiscal mechanisms, some of which have been the subject of much discussion at the legislature, including suspensions of licenses such as driver's license, hunting license, and recreational vehicles and so forth. The budget activity, or excuse me, the budget information for this activity is on page 69. This only includes those dollars that are distributed to counties to support their role in enforcing child support. We'll find on a later page when we get into the administrative budgets for DHS the dollars that are associated with the state's role in enforcing child support. The federal government reimburses 66% of the costs that are involved in child support enforcement, which is a higher rate than we see in most of our other programs. So there's a lot of federal funding that flows into child support enforcement that is represented in this activity.
And Assistant Commissioner, in 2003 we cut this area of support for the counties, and this year, as I understand it, the federal government also is cutting support to the counties in this area. Does the department have any concern about our ability to maintain the kind of collection rates we have had in the past with these cuts?
Madam Chair, that's correct. We did cut it in 2003. We also put in place a 1% fee, which provided revenue that partially, I believe, replaced what was cut in 2003. But the issue at hand now is the reduction in federal reimbursement, which will amount to about a $24 million loss at the local level of the funding that they use to support the operations of child support in Minnesota. We are concerned about that. It represents, depending on what county you're looking at, maybe a quarter to a third of the money that they currently have available to them to enforce child support. Minnesota has historically performed pretty well on child support in terms of the collections, the level of collection of paternity establishment and so forth. We haven't performed as well in terms of the federal measure that is an efficiency measure that actually looks at the amount of dollars we spend on administration per dollar collected. Where the national average is, I believe, something close to $6, and we're around 4.25 in terms of dollars collected per dollar spent on administration. So we don't know, and because we have sort of a sprawling system, as we do in many cases in Minnesota, that involves the counties and the courts and the county attorney's offices, exactly how this is going to play through and what it'll mean in terms of potentially lost collections. We don't have a solid estimate of that. But we are certainly concerned that it's going to compromise the county's ability to stay on top of these cases, and potentially the most difficult cases being the ones that would suffer the most. And those are some that we may potentially care the most about because they may be families where there's an association with MFIP and some of the other programs we run.
And so do you think the reason that we don't have as good a cost-benefit ratio is because we have a county-administered system?
Madam Chair, that's possible, but I don't know that for sure. The legislative auditor, as you recall, did do an audit on this program last year. They didn't come to exactly that conclusion, but they suggested that we had a system that was very complex because of the multiple partners and levels that were involved in the work, and that there may be a way to look at, and we are currently in the process of doing this, whether they're working with the counties, whether there are things that could be done more efficiently at the state level rather than being done at the local level, or whether, in fact, some degree of the entire system may be better operated at the state level rather than having the local level. But those are questions I don't have an answer for right now, but it is certainly a question we're engaged in looking at.
And when would you be bringing us recommendations about those?
Madam Chair, I don't have the exact timing on that. I would guess that it would probably be into the next budget cycle.
Well, that's too bad. We could use it now, I would think, being that we're having this large cut in support for the program. Are there other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
Commissioner Johnson, in this last discussion, you're talking about our system of having the county do the collections. Is that different in the other states where their collection ratio is better?
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, there wasn't in the work that the auditor did, or just in sort of eyeballing the federal rates, which they publish for each state, performance for each state. There wasn't an exact correlation that would suggest it's, you know, clearly county administration that is driving the higher cost. There are only about 12 states, however, that are county administered. So it's a little bit hard, and there's, of course, a variety of other differences between certainly us and California, for example. And so it's hard to say, compare us to some of those other states and make a firm conclusion on that. And that's why I think the auditor's recommendations were a little bit tentative on this as well, because it wasn't absolutely clear why it was that our costs were higher than, I believe we rate 37th, so we're not like the sort of the lowest state on this measure, but we're in the lower half.
Other questions? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is not so much a question, I guess, as a comment at this point. I just always like to connect the dots between the gigantic tax cuts at the federal level to the wealthiest Americans and how it plays out for us at a local level by affecting the poorest women in the state and their ability to have assistance from the state in collecting child support payments.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner, I believe I heard you say that there was a 1% fee enacted. Can you elaborate on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, in 2003 there was a 1% fee created, which is 1% of the collection that's made for a non-public assistance case is essentially taken off and then by the department, and then it's part of what the money that gets distributed then to the counties to support their operation of the program.
So it is taken out of the child support collection. It was not exactly one of our favorite things to do that year, and maybe one of these days we can look at whether we want to keep doing that or not.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, what's the percentage of collections that you do that are public assistance and non-public assistance? Did I miss it?
Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach, I'm checking to see that myself.
I did see it.
You know, it doesn't exactly say, and I'll check
in this caption under this chart on page 67. Oh, it's in this under historical perspective.
Madam Chair, that's actually a slightly different point, which is although most of the cases are non-public assistance, most of those that are non-public assistance had been on public assistance at one time. Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach, I can get that number for you. I don't have it exactly here.
Madam
I know
Chair.
That it's less than half are public assistance, but as the note here says, even though the remainder that are non-public assistance from the way they're treated within the child support system, most of them actually were on public assistance at some time in the past. So even within, when you look across the whole population, most of the families we're serving do have some history, either current or past, with public assistance.
Madam so Chair. Child support collection is an important part of the picture of whether a family is able to remain self-sufficient.
It absolutely is, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair,
Fischbach.
Commissioner, I'd be interested in the numbers, you know, the breakdown of former public assistant and what's keeping them, if the child support collection is keeping them off, any kind of information on that. I'm also wondering, Commissioner, if you could just maybe talk for or try to explain to me how you mentioned that the program evolved. Originally, it was intended for public assistant recipients. And then it evolved. Was that evolution statutory? At what point did we kind of move into the non-public assistance?
Madam Chair and Senator Fischbach, that was actually an evolution at the federal level and the federal law driving the program to open it up to include non-public assistance individuals.
And Madam Chair, Commissioner, were there any regulations put on that? I mean, did it just open it wide up, or was it those who were formerly on public assistance? Any kind of, you know, any kind of qualifications to qualify for that?
Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach, the way that it works is anybody who applies for services from the county. So anybody who comes into us and applies for service, and I believe for non-public assistance, there's a $25 essentially application fee to partially offset some of the costs of doing that. We will then provide the enforcement services that they need to put to get child support paid to their children.
So, Madam Chair, Commissioner, so a woman making and we're just going to say a woman, could be a guy, making $100,000 could come in, who's not getting their child support, could come in, pay the $25 and have the county get the collect the child support for them.
Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach, as I understand it, that's correct. Although that doesn't happen that much because folks who have more money are usually using private attorneys to pursue some of the same kinds of remedies.
Well, and Madam Chair, Commissioner, I understand that. I'm just wondering, as we look at if there, we are facing cuts, if there is some way to, you know, taper it back so that we're really helping those folks, you know, we make the program really help the folks that are we're looking at.
And Madam Chair and Senator Fischbach, and I can get back to you on this, but I'm quite sure that the federal regulations say anyone who comes in and applies and there is without regard to income. And so I believe that we would not be able to do that under the federal law. But we can check into that
for
you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you.
And Senator Fischbach, I believe that the process sort of sifts itself out because the services people get are not always the greatest because of the funding problems. If you're not on public assistance, counties do tend to prioritize public assistance cases, even though they're supposed to serve everybody. And so there are people that are not on public assistance that really feel like they get much better service if they hire their own attorney, if they're able to. Other
Madam
questions?
Chair?
Senator Erickson-Ropes. Excuse me. Senator Sharon.
Yes, I wonder who that is. Yeah. That's great. Commissioner Johnson, the application fee for $25, is that in addition to the 1% fee that's charged on what's collected in order to cover the cost of the program? And my second question is, can the 1% fee be collected not on the amount that you've collected from on behalf of the custodial parent, but can it be a fine or a charge against the person who's to be making the payment?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, to answer the first question, yes, it's in addition. There's a $25 initial, and then there's the 1% fee. It would require state law to change it, essentially, to tack a 1% on top of each child support order that would then be dedicated to, you know, the administrative costs for the counties and the department. I will have staff check on whether there would be any prohibition under that in federal. This is a highly federally regulated program, so we always have to go back and look at our federal regulations to see what we can and can't do. It would require, though, I know, a change in state law to do that because we just established new guidelines, which went into effect on January 1st for child support. There need to be some adjustment to that in order to account for the additional money to offset the cost of running the program.
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Senator Sharon, we did discuss that at the time that that budget change was requested and came up with the fact that it would be much more difficult to implement because when child support is established, you don't know who's not going to pay it. Mm-hmm. And so then trying to increase the support based on the non-payment after the fact is sort of problematic because the court has to order a change in the child support. And so, you know, unless we were going to have a system where everybody who owes child support just kicks a little into the system, it was going to be kind of hard to implement it based on who doesn't pay child support. Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, I guess just a question in response to what you said, and then I had another question also for the Assistant Commissioner. I'm just wondering if we were to do something like that, though, if that might not be a deterrent to those paying child support to avoid paying child support, because then if they were put into the system, it would cost them an extra 1%, so they'd have an incentive to avoid that happening by making timely payments, do you think?
Or? Maybe there is a way that it could be done more automatically. Obviously, this was the year we had, you know, the 300 pages of budget changes, and we didn't have time to spend a lot of thinking about each page. So it might be something that we could look into to see whether it could be more automated in terms of tacking something on to the support payments of those who owe child support and are not paying it.
And then could I ask my question, my additional question? Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner, is the ratio between the amount spent to collect child support payments and the amount actually collected fairly even among our counties around the state, or is there a substantial difference among the counties? And then a follow-on question to that, if there is a substantial difference, do the counties have a lot of flexibility in how they set up the administration of doing the collections, or would you relate any differences more to the demographics of the county?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, there is variation across counties in terms of the percentage of collections. We do have a performance system that we work on with the counties, which actually the dollars that are on this page are distributed based on their performance against measures, including the percent collected. So in that sense, there's an incentive built in for counties. And we also have a project we've been working on a number of years with the largest eight counties, where we work very intensively with those counties, where there do tend to be more challenges, because I think getting to your last question, a lot of it is based on demographics. That isn't solely the only reason. But we know that there are some cases that are more challenging than others, and certainly where a case comes in without having paternity established, for example, you're starting from fairly far behind the eight ball in terms of identifying. We also know that it is much harder to collect on low-income cases, because you're usually looking at both parents being relatively low-income, and so that obligor doesn't have that much money to bring to pay either, and that can lead to issues that make it more difficult to get collection and certainly to get the full collection. So we also have some new initiatives we're focusing on with the counties, focusing on low-income families and how we can do a better job of working, particularly with the obligors, and trying to understand how we get them more engaged in the process of child support, so they don't see it as simply somebody coming to threaten and collect money from them, but see it as a way that we can work with them to figure out how, for instance, to adjust their arrears so that they're not sitting on $10,000 of debt they're never going to pay back, which then disincents them to bother paying the current support. So there's a number of initiatives we're working on to try to address that. But in answer to your question, yes, there is variation across counties. We do try to work with counties on improving across the four or five major measures that we focus on, both by incentive dollars and also by the reporting and the work our staff do in conjunction with counties.
Assistant Commissioner Johnson, could you just talk a little bit about the access and visitation grants?
Madam Chair, I'm not as familiar with that grant. I don't have my person here who is.
Maybe you could just get our staff some information about that then. And also maybe about the Ramsey County PAT education program.
Madam Chair, we'll do that.
And then the other question I have is in regard to the CSE paternity grants. The page says that the activity continues as an administrative activity for 2007 and beyond. I don't understand that. It isn't showing up as... Does that mean that this budget item shows up on a different page in a different column?
Madam Chair,
for
I think
the out years?
It's one where we've changed our approach to how we're dealing with it, and we're not... not distributing these dollars. I believe these dollars used to be contracted to an organization in the community that did some of this training. We're going to move that more in-house, and so I believe the dollars are either sunsetting or they've been moved into one of our internal accounts. I'm not sure which, and I can ask staff to confirm that for me. And we're going to continue doing those activities more through our own staff within the Department of Human Services rather than through the contract that we formerly used to deliver those services.
Well, maybe you could get us some more information about that, and also then where we would find that budget number if we wanted to track it.
Madam Chair, we will do that.
Thank you. Other questions? Let's move on then.
Madam Chair and members, the next budget page is on budget activities on page 70. Shifting gears somewhat, we're now moving into talking about the children's services part of the children and family services. This page encompasses a number of individual grants, many of them funded by federal funds. Excuse me. That support the child welfare system in Minnesota. This page also includes community-based children's mental health grants. Those are actually not within the Children and Family Services Administration. They're within the Chemical and Mental Health Administration, headed by Assistant Commissioner Koistra. So he will talk about those when he does the overview of his budget with his committee, which I believe is next week. I'm only going to speak to the child welfare pieces of it at this point. As many of you are aware, the child welfare system in Minnesota is operated through the counties. It is largely funded. About half of the funding comes from the county, another third from the federal government, and around 15% or so from the state government, much of which is represented in the next couple of pages that we'll look at. This is the system that focuses on child safety, child permanency, and child well-being. At the first instance, it focuses on reports of child abuse and neglect. And investigating those reports where appropriate or bringing services through the family assessment response, which is one of our recent reforms in this system, when that's appropriate. As I discussed a little bit the other day, family assessment response started development in the 1990s. We piloted in the early part of this decade, and it became statewide under state law last year. Family assessment response is a way to engage families when there's a report of abuse or neglect that does not involve serious physical abuse, sexual abuse, imminent harm to the child. Often these are neglect situations as opposed to abuse situations, where instead of the traditional approach, which had been to come in and investigate what was going on and try to figure out if there was someone who was at fault and to assess blame and so forth, we come at these families with much more of a helpful approach. And a family-based approach to try to work with them on assessing what strengths and resources they have, what resources we can help bring to them in order to put that family in a situation where they can do a better job of parenting their child and avoid having to have the child come all the way into the system and certainly get into out-of-home placement and the other costs that go with that. We did a very rigorous evaluation of the pilot of this program, found that not only did it engage families better, did families like it better, but also children were safer in terms of any reported repeat entry into the system for abuse and neglect, and also that it saved money because we were putting fewer children in out-of-home placement, which is the deep end, very costly services that we have within the child safety and permanency system. This budget activity also addresses permanency activities. This is around when children are in foster care, and particularly when parental rights are terminated. Those children then become guardians of the state. And we have an obligation when those children become guardians of the state to try to find a permanent family for them so they're not living in long-term foster care or in some kind of a group home or something. We do that through our adoption activities, which both help locate and find parents who are willing to adopt the children, through adoption assistance, which provides subsidies to families who will adopt children out of the child welfare system, and through relative custody assistance, which is similar for children where parental rights have not been terminated, but there is a transfer of a legal guardianship within the family to another relative. We also provide assistance to those families to help offset the costs of taking on another child in their home. Many of these children are, over half of these children are experiencing some kind of a disability. All of them have been abused or neglected. These are children who have special needs, and this is the system that helps support moving those children as quickly as possible with a real loving family that can help them, put them on a right path as much as possible for the next part of their life. There are a number of initiatives, as I mentioned. There's a list of the grants that goes on quite extensively. A couple that I'd highlight, one that was created in 2005 is American Indian Child Welfare Initiative. This is an initiative that involves state money working with two tribes. We are currently working with Leech Lake and the White Earth Band to develop their own capacity to deliver child welfare services to the members of their community. The system that we have right now, because we have such a large portion of county funding in the child welfare system has created often strains between the tribes and the reservations and the surrounding counties. Because the surrounding counties are often responsible for paying for the services that are ordered by a tribal court, and that creates some friction where you don't have the sort of fiscal responsibility aligning with the decisions that are being made. What this project does is essentially provide state money to allow these two tribes to develop their own capacity to deliver their own services directly and to fund those services so that they can be in a position to work with their community, both from the point of doing the investigations, the initial services to family, through to the permanency work that I talked about a few minutes ago. Another initiative that I would highlight is a Children's Justice Initiative. This is a partnership between the Department of Human Services and the Minnesota Supreme Court. This is an initiative which really focuses on understanding that when children come into the child protection system, there is a role the courts are playing and there's a role that the social workers and the human services system from the county are playing, and that those two roles need to work together to make sure we're always focused on the best interest of the child in the situation we're looking at. So a lot of this has been focused on trying to educate each side about what the court does and what the social workers and the human services system does, as well as trying to focus court practices on being very timely in moving things along, because a couple of months' delay, which could be a normal continuance in any court, can be a really long time for a kid who's waiting to figure out when they're going to get back with their parents or whether they're going to be placed in another home and so forth. And so that's been an initiative that's been ongoing for several years now that we've started to have success with. And we work both with the counties and with the local courts in this as well, but the Supreme Court and ourselves are the primary partners on that. Madam Chair and members, the budget information for this activity is on page 73. You'll see that there are state and federal dollars included here. It's a number of different federal funding streams that flow into this activity, largely Titles 4B and Titles 4E of the Social Security Act, as well as, I mentioned, state general fund. Most of these dollars are distributed to counties, but some of them do go to other nonprofit entities as well.
Assistant Commissioner, can you just explain to us what is where we get the money for what is listed in this section under Special Revenue Fund?
Madam Chair, I believe that this is special revenue that is dedicated revenue from 4E receipts from the adoption assistance program that is then dedicated into these activities. I will check that, though, with my staff. In addition, I was reminded, Madam Chair, there's some foundation grant money that's included here as well.
Okay, well, it'd be nice if we could understand that a little better.
Obviously. Madam Chair, we can give you information on where all the dollars come from.
Okay. And then, again, on the federal funds, if there are matching requirements.
Madam Chair, we can't get back to you. I know there are some matching requirements within the 4B pieces, but it's a complex relationship.
Are there any other questions? Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner, with respect to White Earth and Leech Lake, those two pilot programs you were describing, once they're fully implemented and up to speed and ready to take on those responsibilities, then will all the funding for those programs come from the state, or will there still be county funding into those programs?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, it's our expectation that at that point then all the funding would be coming from the state. But we are still working out pieces of that with the individual sites to figure out if there are still pieces that the county might be responsible for. But our intent was, we wrote the language quite broadly to give us the authority in working with the parties involved to try to make sure that we're putting in place something that's going to cover all the costs that would be incurred by the children who are members of that tribe.
Other questions? Senator Sharon, did you have a question?
I would like to ask a question. Thank you, Madam Chair. When you're working towards the family assessment response and other services for families, during that phase, which may be a less significant or a not rise to the level of acuity that might otherwise be,
do you do an assessment of what the factors are that are creating requirement for the
Are you able to speak to whether how many of those families are unaware that what they're doing would be considered neglect or abuse?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I don't know the answer to the second piece. I would guess that we don't track that in any way. I may be able to gather some anecdotal information from counties as to how much that happens, or from people who have more experience in the child welfare system. To the first part of your question, we have designed and done training on certain assessment tools that are used with families to try to identify what kinds of issues are going on with the family. We also are in the process of developing some screening tools which counties will have to use to determine, when they're screening a case, what kind of response should be done with the case. Because right now that is set out in the law, and we've trained the counties on it, but we haven't really done it at a level of having sort of great degree of consistency and commonality across the entire state and how that's being done. And that would get into what kind of factors you'd be looking for as to what kind of a response you should take, or whether it's a case that would be screened entirely out of the child welfare system, which often happens when we get a report. We identify that we don't believe that there's abuse or neglect going on, that case would be screened out.
Madam Chair, maybe just more a comment. What I'm thinking about is if you determine that the family is not even aware that what they're doing is considered neglect or abuse, that it would not so much be important with only that family, but if you see a trend in that, in these families, that when you see a young child in the grocery store and the parent is yanking that child's arm nearly out of their arm socket and in front of a group of people without any sense that they're acting outside of a reasonable behavioral pattern, that it would direct us, if you have a trend that you can see that the definition of what is or is not negligent or abusive behavior is unknown to huge portions because it becomes the standard in their family, that a public health program, an information program generally, that demonstrates or shows to the community what we're talking about so that people can say, that what I am doing would fit that definition. It would increase their own spontaneous seeking of assistance rather than waiting for a report or an intervention process.
And Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I agree completely. And that is actually part of the continuum of services that we do provide. We have not a lot, but we have some grant money through the Children's Trust Fund that is dedicated to child abuse prevention, which is really to try to get working mostly through community groups that are out working with the families that are most at risk of coming into the system, to try to help with parenting education, to try to help with understanding, where those lines are drawn and what's appropriate behavior and what isn't, and trying to educate other people, educating the educators, as it were, the other people who are interacting with those families, so that we can do more on the prevention side and not often have to see these families coming into the system at all.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner Johnson. Back to the Children's Justice Initiative monies. It looks like an 0809, but in parentheses in the description, MAPS will be updated for 08 and 09 at $125,000 per year. I understand this is grants to counties that have set up their own initiative in each county. And then I know the Supreme Court Justice Blatt's got this started, and I'm actually serve on that, but this is not going to be funded, and we're expecting the rest of the counties to follow suit that have not received grant monies. Can I make myself clear?
Madam Chair. Senator Rosen, your question is generally what's happening with this money and is it going away?
Is it going away, and are we going to expect, Madam Chair, excuse me, and Commissioner Johnson, are we going to expect the rest of the counties to have an initiative in place and to be funded by themselves with assistance from the state?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, my understanding is that that's essentially a correct characterization. This was a federal grant that was time limited and is running out. We are it's not a lot of money to begin with in terms of distributing it across, you know, the whole of the state. And it was mostly to try to facilitate some of the meeting and talking that needs to happen between the parties. It is always helpful to have a little bit of money to seed that, but we certainly are hopeful that we can continue to get that kind of activity going without having to have the seed money. And we do actually have Children's Justice Initiative across the state now. It's just sort of the level of the first counties that got engaged are much more engaged than those who came in the more recent addition. I think it was the four phases. I can't remember, but the fourth phase. And so we do have some work to do with those fourth phase counties and areas. But my understanding is that this is a federal grant that's running on. That's why it shows like this on the budget page.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment that I do think this is a very important initiative because it brings all the counties up to one level, and one page. And whether there's the fourth phase or the third phase is as active and participate as much as the first phase. I know that the first phase is trying to help the counties that are coming in on the third phase. But I do think we need to watch this and make sure that it keeps going, that it doesn't die, because it certainly has been successful, and we've seen some results. I know there's some other initiatives out there. The National Drug Endangered Children, the DEC program, would like to. That was actually a bill of mine, but the governor is going to be implementing a program like that in the state, and I think we need to make sure that all these programs dovetail together to serve our children better and to help the counties out.
Other questions?
A little speech.
Now let's move on then.
Madam Chair, members, the next base budget activity is on page 77. This encompasses children and community services grants. This is largely, I think there are a few strays in here, the Child and Community Services Act, which was created in 2003, funded at a level of about $100 million. This is a block grant to counties to support their social services efforts. It was created in 2003 out of 15 separate individual grants that existed at that time. The biggest one of which was called CCSSA, just to confuse us, which was also a block grant to counties for social services. This took CCSSA and added in some other categorical grants that existed at that time, were put together. The funding was reduced by about $25 million a year, and CCSA, the Child and Community Services Act, was created. This was done both as a consolidation effort of a number of individual grants, but obviously both also because we were facing a budget deficit in 2003, and this was one of the places where savings were taken. CCSA operates as a block grant to counties. Counties submit to us a biennial service agreement, which is a little bit different than the kinds of plans we used to do with counties. It is an agreement that is focused on achievement of outcomes. It's biennial, so every 2 years counties submit to us a plan showing what their plan for improvement is on the outcomes that we measure for children within this block grant. We measure how well they're doing against that. They also present us the strategies they're using for accomplishing those outcomes and so forth. We've also used that process to focus on disparities within the system for racial ethnic groups who are not doing as well as we're doing with the overall population in Minnesota. And so we've also used that process to get counties to focus on where they have disparities and measures within the child welfare system and to present us with plans for how they're going to improve in those areas. The dollars in the block grant are required under law that 40% have to be used for children. The rest can be used for other social services, which can encompass people with developmental disabilities, mental health issues, the elderly, other low-income individuals, other services the county may provide. So it's fairly wide open in that respect, with the exception of the focus of 40% of the dollars on children. Counties are actually spending a little over 50% on children, so that's sort of how the breakdown comes. As is listed at the bottom part of page 77, there are a lot of different services. Again, this is broad. There's broad flexibility for the counties in terms of how they use these dollars to deliver services, and there's variation across counties in how they actually do that. In 2005, we served 350,000 Minnesotans with the dollars in this block grant. The funding for this activity is on page 80, includes state and federal dollars. Most of the federal dollars are the Title 20 Social Services Block Grant dollars that are provided to the state for social services.
Are there any questions? Seeing none, let's move on then.
Madam Chair, members, the next budget activity is on page 82. This is general assistance grants. General assistance is a cash assistance program that is provided to low-income single individuals and childless couples. So it's essentially the individuals who are low-income and need help with an income support who are not eligible for MFIP. It's the other folks. This is an entirely state-funded, general-funded activity in Minnesota. The eligibility for the program has 15 categories. They're largely focused on disabilities or other reasons that would prevent a person from working. About 14,000 people on GA right now. Most of those people, as suggested by the eligibility, people have some kind of a disability. Doesn't always rise to the level of making them eligible for federal disability assistance, which is SSI. Although one of the very active ingredients of this program is that we do work with the individuals in GA to identify whether they might be eligible for SSI and to try to transition them to SSI whenever possible. That both helps them because SSI pays more than twice what GA pays. It also helps us in the sense that SSI is a federally funded program. The benefit for general assistance for a single individual with no other income is $203. It's a very low benefit. Most of these individuals will also receive food stamps. This program has a long history in Minnesota. At one point, it was a wide open program in the sense of not having categorical eligibility. For a while, we had a work readiness program, which is essentially a separate program for work-ready people who might otherwise be eligible for GA. That program went away sometime, I believe, in the late 90s, probably. And since then, we've had a GA program, which is focused on individuals who have some barrier to work. The budget information, Madam Chair, is on page 84. It's, as I suggested, state funding.
Any questions? Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner, do you know what the average period of time is between the time a person would apply for SSI and actually start receiving benefits? And during that period of time, is it reasonable to expect that someone lives on $203 a month?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I don't have the average, although I could probably get that for you. What I do know is it can take a long time to become eligible for SSI. Most cases make an initial application, are denied, and then appeal. It's a very common pattern to be denied, to appeal, and only at the appeal stage do you then actually end up being eligible. We do, because we are working with a lot of individuals trying to get onto SSI, I'm sure that I can get that information for you about what the average is. I don't know that I could ever say that it's reasonable to expect someone to live on $203 a month. I would guess the answer to that is no. And these people are often doubling up or have some other income coming from somewhere in order to be able to live. Because the $203 a month isn't enough to pay rent almost anywhere, I think, in the state.
Other questions? Continue.
The next budget activity is on page 85, Minnesota Supplemental Aid Grants. Minnesota Supplemental Aid, or SSI, is essentially a state supplement, or I'm sorry, MSA, is essentially a state supplement to the SSI program. SSI, as I mentioned before, is the federal program that pays benefits to low-income, aged, and disabled individuals. MSA is a federal requirement that Minnesota has because we had a program that existed prior to the creation of SSI. We had a state program, and there was something built into the federal law that essentially required us to have a maintenance of effort to continue to provide benefits and assistance to certain individuals on SSI. This covers older individuals who are low income. These are folks who, for whatever reason, usually don't have Social Security or only have a little bit of Social Security. Those who are blind or impaired vision, and those who have disabilities. And as we just discussed, there's a termination process you need to go through to get eligible for SSI under the federal law, which then will bring the MSA. The average supplement grant under MSA is $86 a month. about 28,000 individuals currently receiving it.
Questions? Let's continue then.
Madam Chair, I didn't mention that this is 100% state funded, and that is on page 87. The next budget activity is on page 88, Group Residential Housing. Group Residential Housing, or GRH, provides income supplements for room, board, and other related housing services for folks whose illnesses or disabilities don't allow them to live independently in the community. Essentially, this provides the supplement to someone who's living in, who has a disability or another condition, who's living in a licensed facility, and there's certain kinds of licensed facilities that they can be living in and get the GRH supplement. Under DHS licensing, it's the adult foster home licensing. There's also a number under health, boarding, lodging establishment, supervised living facility, and boarding care home. These are individuals who usually have some kind of a disability. Many of them are on SSI, and the GRH is essentially a supplement on top of the SSI. But there are some who are not on SSI who would otherwise be GA eligible, but because they're living in one of these facilities, are instead getting GRH. The GRH payment goes to the facility for the room and board cost that they have of caring, of housing that individual. Most of these individuals, certainly those who are on SSI, are also eligible for medical assistance. So the services that they need to serve them because of the disabilities or their mental retardation or developmental disabilities are often provided by medical assistance, waivered services, the other pieces that are within that existing infrastructure. But not all are. And in that case, GRH also pays a supplementary rate to cover the services that that facility may be providing to the individuals that are living there.
Questions? Now let's continue.
The next budget activity is on page 91, Refugee Services Grants. Refugee Services Grants are 100% federal grants that are provided to Minnesota to help with the resettlement of refugees who end up in Minnesota. Refugees, most of you are probably aware, are individuals who come from other countries under threat of persecution, and they can't go back to their own country because of the conditions there, often war or some other kind of strife, that has made it impossible for them to go back. Minnesota has a long history of bringing refugees into this country, starting with the Southeast Asian population back in the 70s up till now when we're settling a lot of East Africans in Minnesota. Minnesota consistently ranks the second or third state in terms of the numbers of refugees that are resettled in any given year. These grants provide a variety of different services to the refugee populations, including refugee cash assistance. This would be for folks who are not eligible for MFIP. Many of the refugees who come in as families come into the MFIP program rather than going into the refugee services. Refugee medical assistance, which again is for those who may not be eligible for the existing medical assistance program, as well as social services, employment services, other kinds of services to help orient the individuals to Minnesota, to the United States, and to our culture. These services are particularly important in the context of the MFIP system because many of the refugee families do come into MFIP. These services really help us sort of another ring of services and support around what's provided within the MFIP system to help the refugees, excuse me, with their additional needs that they bring. As I mentioned, the budget for this activity is on page 92, and it is federal funding that we receive under the refugee programs at the federal level.
Any questions? Let's continue then.
Madam Chair and members, on page 93 is the next budget activity, Other Child and Economic Assistance Grants. This page encompasses a variety of different activities, as suggested by its title. The focus here is largely on food, housing, and some of our work with community organizations. The largest dollar item within this page is the food stamp program, which we call Food Support in Minnesota. This is the piece of the food support program that is provided to people who are not on MFIP. The piece on MFIP we talked about in the first budget activity. We have about 250,000 individuals who are on food support in Minnesota. In addition to that food activity, we also have activities here that involve work that we do with food shelves in terms of passing through commodities as part of our role in the federal commodity program, as well as work that we do in terms of the distribution of food to food shelves that we're responsible for. We have some housing responsibilities that are on this page. This page includes our piece of the Ending Long-Term Homelessness Initiative that the governor put in place several years ago. Last year, or in 2005, the legislature appropriated $10 million for the biennium for support services for individuals who are experiencing long-term homeless. We administer those dollars, have distributed them to the counties. In addition, we have transitional housing, which helps individuals who are coming from homelessness to transition into permanent housing, is a program that we administer. We also oversee the community action agencies. Those are 39 agencies spread across the state. Community-based agencies were created in the federal law some 40 years ago. We provide some funding to them. They get most of their funding from a variety of other places, like any other community-based organization, but they do have a special designation within the federal law and special oversight that we provide. Madam Chair, the budget for numbers for this activity are on page 95. It includes mostly federal dollars that we're passing through with these activities, as well as a few other items.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Senator Sharon and I have a question about the graph on page 94. Would you describe participation rate or define it? This would look like we have 69% in poverty in Minnesota, but I'm wondering if it's the participation rate of those in poverty.
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, yes, that is a little bit confusing. This is the percent of people in poverty who are receiving food stamps. So 69% of the people in poverty in Minnesota, or in 2005, 71%, are receiving food stamps. In theory, they're all eligible. And so the reason we track this is we have some outreach efforts that we're administering to try to bring more individuals into the food stamp program and let them take advantage of that benefit, which is federally funded and available to virtually anyone under 130% of the poverty level. The senior bar is presented there because that is a particularly challenging population to get into the food stamp program. A lot of resistance based on just the stigma that they feel of being part of the program. There's a portion of this kind of built in, which is if they're a senior receiving SSI, they're likely to only get $10 in food stamps, and it's often just not worth it to them to go through the process for the $10 benefit. But the reason those are presented there is because we are actively engaged in outreach efforts to try to bring more individuals into the food stamp program.
Assistant Commissioner Johnson, is the governor's initiative to end long-term homelessness measuring its progress?
Madam Chair, we are. And we had a target of, I believe, 1,000 supportive housing units that we're supposed to be at, and we're at about 1,100 right now. So we are ahead of that target in terms of creating the supportive housing units for people experiencing long-term homeless. The next sort of measure we'll have is when the Wilder study comes out. As most of you may be familiar, Wilder measures homelessness every 3 years in Minnesota, the Wilder Research Foundation. And that'll give us a sense of whether the numbers have changed at all from the measure that we had 3 years ago in terms of the number of long-term homeless are on the street.
I think that was the kind of measure I was thinking of. Just because you do something doesn't mean you reach your goal, so...
Madam Chair, absolutely.
And when will that be coming out?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure. It usually comes out within the next couple of months because they did the survey where they go out on one night and do their count in October, and it's usually 5 to 6 months later that the results come out.
And that would be what you would use to measure the success of your efforts so far?
I think it would be, Madam Chair, although I would suggest that it's fairly early in the process still to be looking at October of 06 when we still have a goal of creating 4,000 units, and we're only, you know, just a little over a quarter of the way there. I'm not sure how much progress we'll see in that time period, but certainly that should be a first benchmark for us to look at.
Any other questions? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner. I'm only concerned about when they set benchmarks and do measurements like this, that we're using the same set in 1 year and comparing them the following year or in following years. Because certainly I've been around the block enough to know that, you know, your studies show whatever you intend to prove on the other end. And, you know, I have seen benchmarks change. You know, there's a measurement here, and then you want to have a particular outcome over here, and you change the benchmark. So are you using the Wilder data from previous years and measuring the same benchmarks against that?
Madam Chair and Senator Erickson Ropes, yes, we are. That is it's sort of the definitive measure of homelessness in Minnesota, and certainly all the homeless community, the three agencies that are involved in the initiative ourselves, Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and Department of Corrections, all rely on their work. They have a very consistent methodology they've used over the course of years to do that. And so we're very confident that we're getting a good measure, a good snapshot every 3 years of what the homeless population looks like in Minnesota.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, let's move on.
Madam Chair, the next two budget pages relate to the Children and Family Services administrative accounts, which by the agenda, I wasn't sure if you wanted to do the forecast overview before you got into that, or if you want me to just plow right in through these last two pages.
Well, I was told that you weren't sure you had someone here to do the forecast.
I would have to check that to make sure.
And so somehow there was a little miscommunication.
I guess, Madam Chair, we're not going to do that today.
Okay, so that's what I had marked down, that okay. We would try and do that on a different day. So whatever else you were going to do.
Okay, Madam Chair,
next.
Then I will move on to page 98. This moves us into a new what's called a program. On these pages, I don't understand the exact titling of these things, but this is essentially the administrative activity within the Children and Family Services that supports all of the programmatic activity that I just talked about in the previous 13, I believe, budget pages. This is split into two separate activities, and I'll talk about the activities in turn. The first starts on page 101. This is called Children and Family Services Administration. This is really the activity that includes the staff and the other costs at DHS for supporting all the core programs, largely in terms of policy support and program development and training and the other kind of work that we do to support the work of the counties and the other folks who deliver the services at the local level. It crosses all of the major areas I just talked about, the economic assistance programs, child support enforcement, child services, child care services, and child welfare. This includes the support that we provide to counties in terms of training and instruction manuals, bulletins that give them guidance on changes in policy, changes in procedure, technical assistance and training we do on areas where we're struggling with performance or struggling in terms of compliance and making sure that we're following the correct laws. This also includes staff who do policy interpretation kind of work. That involves when there's a change in the federal law, looking at those changes and trying to understand what we need to do in Minnesota, looking at changes that come out of the legislature and how we have to change our guidance to the local level in terms of delivering those programs and so forth. This is the part of our administrative activity that involves development of new programs, pilot projects, new ideas, bringing forward, developing initiatives that the department is moving forward, either in the legislative process or things that we're doing internally or working with foundations or working with counties or others in the community. This is also an area where we have a number of staff who work in the compliance area, ensuring that we're complying with federal laws, that counties are complying with federal laws, and in our oversight or quality assurance of the programs to ensure that we're focusing on improving programs wherever we can within Minnesota. The budget activity is on page 102. There's allotment detail that follows that. Much of the funding here is federal funding in concert with the funding of our programs. We do receive federal funding to assist with the administration of the programs, but there's additional general fund as well.
You say much of the funding is federal, but it isn't. By federal, do you mean TANF funding?
Madam Chair, the federal includes both TANF and there would be other reimbursement that we get through the cost allocation agreements we have with the federal government, which would probably include, in this case, some food stamp dollars, federal 4B dollars, federal 4E reimbursements, and there may be additional smaller dedicated categorical grants from the federal government that would also be included here.
Okay, but you don't have those listed here then?
Madam Chair, I don't believe that they're listed in the allotment detail. No, the source of funding I don't believe is listed in the allotment detail.
I guess we'd like to get that if we could.
Okay.
Are there other questions? Not. Let's. Does that conclude your presentation?
One more.
One more? Okay.
One more. Madam Chair, on page 103.
Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner, could we go back to these pages on administration once more? And I see that these are the FTEs for 2008 and 2009. Is that a change from past years?
Madam Chair and Senator Pretner Solon, I believe if you look at I guess it doesn't give you the past history. I'm going to say if you look at page 102, the bottom line of that page shows FTEs. The current FTEs in this activity, and then the FTEs as projected in the governor's recommend or in the out years. We could get a past biennium too if you'd like to look at what the trend is there.
Please, thank you.
I think the difficulty here is that on the white pages you do list the actual FTEs, and on the yellow pages, what you have. Done is list them out how many by each category so they're not added up. Or at least if they are, I don't see where they are. Well, what you have here is a total of 68.5 on the fiscal year 08-09, but then on the other sheet you've got 203.4, so it's kind of hard to figure out how you would compare them.
Madam Chair, the details provided in the yellow pages is only the direct funded appropriations, general fund, healthcare access, TANF. It does not include statutory appropriations or the federal statutory appropriations. We can provide that additional detail.
Okay, thank you. All right, then let's continue.
Madam Chair and members, page 103 is the other piece of the administrative infrastructure for Children and Family Services. This is called Children and Family Operations. The largest focus of this activity is on our systems, computer systems. The Children and Family Services Administration operates three what we call major systems. The MAXIS system, which is an eligibility system for all our cash assistance programs, for our food stamp program, and additionally currently for our health care programs. This system both determines eligibilities and benefits. It also includes all of the automated mailing out of all the communication we do with clients, as well as managing the electronic benefit transfer system, which is the piece whereby individuals take a card to access their cash assistance or their food benefits if they're buying food at a store. This also includes the PRISM system, which is a system that supports the child support operations. As I mentioned before, that is a very complex area. This supports all of the payment and payment distribution eligibility issues, as well as enforcement mechanisms that we do through the child support enforcement program. And the third major system is SSIS, Social Services Information System. This supports social services at the local level, primarily in the children's area, the child welfare area. And this is a system that provides case management support as well as reporting and tracking to the counties and the county workers. Each of these systems are systems that are operated by the state, but are used by the county workers. They're the ones who actually put the data into it and do all the work with the clients at the local level interfacing with our systems. They also allow us, as I mentioned before, to integrate some of the backdoor operations at the state level, such as payments and mailings and the distribution of money and so forth, through our automated systems. These systems exist to meet federal requirements that we have for automation and for reporting of our work. That is what's primarily involved in this page. In addition, this activity includes some of our quality control and program integrity initiatives, particularly around the food stamp program and also in the child support area. These are federal required quality control initiatives that we have to have in place to ensure that we're making proper use of the federal dollars. If you look on page 105, you will see the budget laid out for the operations area, as well as the allotment detail that follows.
Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner Johnson, do any of these systems have the capacity so that if someone is receiving support through one of these programs and would be eligible for health care and did not have it, that you would be able to tell that?
Madam Chair, to a degree, the MAXIS system is able to do that. The MAXIS system currently is doing eligibility for GMC and medical assistance. Minnesota Care is not done through the MAXIS system. So when a person, an individual, comes in and applies for assistance at the county, they're given a combined application form, which is the application form they use for cash, food, and health care programs. And if they request health care, then that worker will enter the information and MAXIS will do the eligibility for the health care programs as well. If they don't request it, then the county worker will often ask them if they need health care and do you want us to check that out too, because it can all be done sort of as a single process. Minnesota Care, because it's separate, is different. That relies more on having a referral from that county worker to say, well, gee, you're not eligible for MA, but you may be eligible for Minnesota Care, and then it depends on whether that county does Minnesota Care eligibility or whether they need to refer them to the state office for that process.
So it only would work if you're applying for cash assistance?
No, Madam Chair. If you came into the county and just said you wanted health care, you would fill out the combined application form.
No, I'm talking about people who don't ask for it but who are eligible for it. I'm focusing on the, 80% of the uninsured children in this state who are eligible for our programs but not enrolled.
Madam Chair, this would really only capture those who are already connected somehow into our system through applying for other kinds of benefits.
And which other benefits would they be connected to health care with?
This would be any of the cash assistance programs, MFIP, GAMSA, et cetera, as well as food stamps.
Okay, so if you're not applying for MFIP, most of those other things are not eligible for families, but if you're not applying for MFIP, then there is no way to link you to a health care program?
Madam Chair, I don't believe so.
For example, when you would apply for assistance with child support, or if you would apply for fuel assistance, or if you would apply for WIC funding?
In child support, this wouldn't be something that the system would do automatically, but because medical support has become such an important part of child support, there will be some work done around the medical needs of children, how those are going to be met, and whether potentially a public program will come into play. But there isn't something that would automatically happen through PRISM to make them eligible. They would have to then make an application for the other program.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions?
Madam Chair, now I am done.
Okay, are there any questions in general for the Assistant Commissioner? If not, thank you very much for your presentation. And
thank you, Madam Chair.
Look forward to seeing you when you have your forecast people here. With that, the meeting will be adjourned.